So first things first, hello everybody, but I need to express my excitement about the Dodgers winning their first World Series since 1988 when I was 1 year old. I have grown up going to Dodgers games my entire life, and I swear every year the heartbreak that has felt in Los Angeles for, you know, the multiple times we've been robbed of the World Series is a little bit real. And now that we've won it officially, I'm just so happy for all my friends and family who've been waiting so long. I had to FaceTime my dad last night to congratulate him, and I asked if he bet any money on it, and he's like, I don't bet anymore. And I was like, well, that's a bummer. That's the wrong time to stop. Anyway, that's go Dodgers. So let's get down to business. Election day is far less than a week away. By the time that this posts, I think it'll be like 4 days away. We've got a lot to talk about. There are close races at every level, many of which are not focused on nationally too much because, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. But we're going to dive into the details with my friend and colleague, Nicole Brenner-Schmitz, who is the Queen Insider in D.C. And I'll introduce her in the episode. Enjoy. Hello, Nicole.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I am thrilled to introduce to you all Nicole Brenner-Schmitz, who is a DC Democratic political operative queen, and also one of my best friends here. So she's been amazing. So Nicole, how many years have you been in DC for those who don't know you?
Oosh, I moved to DC in December of 2006.
So you were a little baby.
I was a baby.
So over the years, you have made lots of moves. One of the I guess more notorious ones is as the political director of the Teamsters, right?
Yeah.
How long were you there?
I was there for about 9 years.
Okay, what do you have to tell us? What's an interesting anecdote or something that we should know about when you worked for the Teamsters? Anything.
For a minute. I mean, I would say it was great to come up in the land of men. It prepares you well for DC.
Yeah. So among labor groups, you were one of the very few women political directors, at least for a long time, right?
That's true. Yeah, there are not very many of us. There still aren't, I think, a lot of them.
Yeah. And then you were the former political director at NARAL, which is one of the country's biggest advocacy groups for women's rights and for abortion rights.
Yep.
Given that, do you have any super quick insights on the Supreme Court and the discussions around choice that we're having right now?
You know, I never thought that I would have to make sure that my daughter had as secure an abortion fund as she does a college fund, that I'd be contemplating her having less rights than me. But I do think I think maybe it's getting disproven, a little bit of a misconception that Republicans are more motivated by the Supreme Court. I think they certainly talk about it more, and I think that they do more actually on the legislative side. They've been prioritizing it a little more, but I think we see that every time something really horrendous happens with SCOTUS, Democrats do have an electorate that turns out in a very different way and votes in a way that reflects they're upset with the fact that we're going to have a court that represents the minority of beliefs in this country, which is that, you know, 2/3 of people are pro-choice and think Roe should stay.
Yeah, totally. Okay, and now you're a political consultant and tell me if I'm getting this right when I describe it, but 10 different Democratic organizations from labor to ideological PACs and you help them determine which races to invest in, how much to spend, where to move the money around, how to make choices around who they're supporting, things like that. Is that?
Yeah, that's some of it. I'm a consultant for many different organizations. I wear a different hat at each one. So political consultant is certainly the covers all bases and what I do.
There we go. Well, what I know is that you have a mind like a steel trap when it comes to remembering all the different races and the dynamics of each of them. And I'm always just amazed every time that we talk as far as how easily you can just recall these races without even looking at anything and, you know, every little bit of detail about them. So for this podcast, I wanted to kind of talk with you a little bit about the races that are not getting as much attention this time around, because the presidential race is so focused on, and the Senate races are so focused on. So I thought we could kind of work our way up from the state level to up to Congress. And, you know, the reason that I think the state legislature and other state races need to be paid attention to so much now is that we're seeing the impacts of having Republican run states and how much of an impact that has on voting rights. Right?
Yeah.
Like it happens at the state level. Unless we pass a federal law that you know, overrides basically statewide laws around elections, then, you know, it has to happen at the state level. So, you know, we've seen how that plays out. And I think it's going to result in a lot of people not having their vote counted. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. So why don't you talk to us about, you work with with groups that are also working on flipping state legislatures. And I know that there's about 10 that I think are kind of on the target, 10 different chambers to flip in state houses and state senates. And some of them don't even have it set up like that. So walk us through some of that, those dynamics really quick.
Yeah. I mean, I think state legislatures get overlooked constantly, right? And I was really excited, actually, in this past week, there's been, I think, a lot more attention paid, some of it celebrities and people pointing at places that you should spend money that help state legislatures. And this now tends to happen towards the very end of cycles. But what we need to remember is that it's important to remember this the whole cycle long. Mm-hmm. And it brings you back to what you were just saying about the Supreme Court too, right? Like, if there's states where they have certain laws passed that something's codified, then, you know, people there might be able to access that right. But
right. So like in California, for example, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned at the federal level, it doesn't mean that it's going to get overturned automatically. But there are states across the country that if Roe v. were, they've set it up that there's like a trigger so that if Roe v. Wade is overturned at the federal level, then that automatically means that abortion is illegal in their states.
Right.
So that's what you mean when you say that it could be codified.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But there are multiple legislatures that could flip this cycle. And some of them are really exciting, like the Arizona, you know, House and Senate, which haven't been Democratic, I think, since the 1960s.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. and Texas, right? The House, they're 9 seats away there.
That's pretty amazing too. I don't think anyone would have even, you know, we know that Texas is now a toss up for the first time in our adult lifetime. Right. But, you know, to think that their House, their actual, one of their chambers could flip is kind of, that's insane.
Yeah.
To me.
It would be incredible. Michigan House is up for grabs. The Minnesota Senate could flip, which would make another trifecta state, which means Democrats would hold all three chambers, the governor, the House, and then the Senate. The Pennsylvania Senate could flip. We could see both the houses in North Carolina. Those are there. And there's some important things, like in Kansas, we could break a supermajority, which would help Governor Laura Kelly a lot. So there's so many opportunities across the country in state legislatures and so many things that they affect. One of them, and most important really to the people in D.C., is gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. Some of these states have been held hostage in both their state houses and their congressional districts by these lines that are insane by all the purposes. If you really look at how they've drawn a lot of these districts, it makes no logical sense other than they're trying to pack as many Democrats into as few a districts as possible so that Republicans can continue to have a chance at majorities in certain states. And I think if we see these state legislatures actually flip this cycle, we're going into another redistricting period. I mean, that was what was devastating about 2010. It wasn't just that we lost, I can't remember the exact number, I think it was 986 state legislative seats across the country.
Oh,
I might be by a seat or two. And several chambers, but it was that we were going into a redistricting cycle. And so we just got totally screwed.
That's That's a great point. I mean, here we are 10 years later, and we have the opportunity to, you know, flip the script for the next, I mean, this is why the census has mattered so much. And this is why the next 2 years, hopefully people are paying just as much attention as they have been, because the redistricting is all going to happen after we get the results of the census. And, you know, we're going to have to vote on new congressional districts by the next, congressional races in 2022. So that's a lot for people to be paying attention to. And there might even be more dynamics at play in the state legislatures leading up to that. And this is, you know, this is another opportunity for people in states like California or New York who want to have an impact across the rest of the country. But if you're not paying attention, you know, a $500 contribution to a state legislature race is huge. Yeah.
For a meeting in Kansas, it's a max out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you think we'll get any state legislature results before we get presidential results? Or do you think that it's going to be more, since they're smaller races, that they'll be more impacted by delayed vote counts?
I mean, historically, it's just more delayed because, they're smaller number of voters. So if they're close races, like we expect a lot of them to be, even though they might end up going our way, it takes a while. I mean, North Carolina is counting, obviously, beforehand, which is why we expect to know who wins the presidential. So possibly that's one that, with both the House and the Senate in play there, we could know earlier rather than later. But I think we have to be very ready for it to take a while to get results in a lot of these districts.
Right. So what about the governor's races? What are we looking at there?
It's an interesting cycle because there are only 11 gubernatorial races in 2020. That doesn't count the three that happened in the off year in 19. And honestly, it's a lot of safe seats on both sides. So we just haven't had a conversation about governors, which means we haven't had a conversation about an executive, which is interesting in the year of this COVID and how much governors were important to what was happening in their states and being in a presidential. So, I mean, really, North Carolina, Governor Roy Cooper is up for re-election, although he looks good. Looks like the Republican governors have basically pulled their money out, the RGA, to send it elsewhere.
Because they're basically like, it's a lost cause.
They think that he's going to win, and they're better off spending their money in the two other competitive governor's races that we have right now, Montana and Missouri.
Got it.
So, which are interesting, right? Because those are not presidential targets. It's not places where you're seeing, you know, those campaigns dump money. But you saw Steve Bullock do a great job as governor of Montana, which he currently is, right? So it's an open seat. It's his seat. That's open. And we saw him decide to run for the Senate at the second last day you can file.
Wow.
But he was coming off of a great 8 years as governor, but also a fantastic leadership that he went into leading then on COVID and doing such a phenomenal job for Montana. And he really benefited from that executive experience. So it's interesting that we just haven't seen, I think we had a lot of governors that were up this cycle, how states had been governed and how they were handling COVID would be even more consequential. Yeah. We just don't have them. And then next cycle, it's like 32 or 33 gubernatorial seats are up. It's a phenomenal amount. So all of a sudden, we're going to go from having not really talked about governors to a lot of conversation about who's in charge of these states.
And that's for the 2022 election year?
Yeah.
Okay, so the two races that we're really looking at on the Senate side are Missouri and Montana, right?
For the governors, yeah.
Yeah. So Missouri, what's the situation there?
So Missouri has an interesting gubernatorial lineup. So the state auditor, who was elected statewide, Nicole Galloway, is running, and she is running against the incumbent governor, who was the lieutenant governor and was promoted up when the governor of Missouri had to leave in a bit of scandal. So he's not actually run for governor either, technically, although he is the sitting governor.
Got it.
So this has become a COVID election. Talk about other things for sure, but the way that they've led on COVID has really dominated the attacks and the defense in this race. So it's a really interesting dynamic. Nicole Galloway is a phenomenal. She's young. She's a mom. She just has like spectacular political sense. Like you just feel that about her the minute you meet her. She's genuine. Nice. She's so Missouri. And I mean that in the compliment, right? Like, you know, when people, it's like they're from there and they know their constituents. And it was a race that, you know, a lot of people counted out for a long time. And now it's truly competitive. I mean, she's only down by 2 or 3 points in polling. And it would be an awesome win to find.
Oh, yeah, she is young.
Yeah, someone in Missouri.
That's awesome.
Be a statewide a Dem again.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, do you say, you said that that's a state where they're trying to break a supermajority? Or no, that's Kansas.
That's Kansas. Yeah.
Got it.
Missouri, okay. Unfortunately, is pretty Republican dominated.
Yeah. State legislature. So what about Montana? What's the situation there?
So in Montana, you have the lieutenant governor who is running against the man who currently occupies the U.S. House seat. So your former colleague.
Yeah. And I never got to know him, I got to say.
I don't think you're missing a lot. But as you know, when you're the U.S. rep in Montana, you're the statewide, right? They only have one rep because it's, you know.
So small.
Population-wise.
Population-wise, yeah.
It's a barn burner. I mean, look. People talk about Montana as so red, and like, granted, it votes Republican, it votes presidential red.
Yeah.
But John Tester has been the senator he's been re-elected 3 times now. He's a Democrat. Bullock's been the governor for 8 years. He was the AG for 8 years before that. I mean, they elect Democrats. And Steve Bullock has shown amazing leadership in Montana as governor. He did a phenomenal job with them with COVID. His lieutenant governor can be part of that, right? Like he's part of that administration. He can talk about their success together, having done this work. So there's piles of money being spent there
from both sides.
And that's sort of where that North Carolina money from the Republicans went, because they really see this as if they don't take it in a presidential year, you know, they're kind of giving it away for a while.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I just spent a bunch of time in Montana and I was pretty shocked at how, some people were far more liberal than I expected. So I don't know. I'm more optimistic about Montana than I was before visiting. So that's something
streak, right? Don't bother me. We won't bother you. We're going to do our hard work. Everybody should pitch in, right? Like there's a strong libertarian streak that actually, you say that and you think, oh, that's right wing, but it's not. It's in that's why they're a pro-choice state, that, you know, like,
yeah.
They're like, I don't need the government telling me things to do.
Right. Right. Totally. Okay. So then that takes us to the House races. And what I'm really interested in you kind of walking us through here is, you know, we have the toss-up column, right, that we're hearing about, where these are the races that are, you know, whether they're incumbents or open seats or Democratic challengers to Republican incumbents that are the most kind of up for grabs. And these are a lot of my former colleagues. But you and the organizations that you work for are calculating like how much money to spend in these districts and when and in response to what the Republicans are doing. And that's kind of the interesting thing about, you know, outside money is that you can't coordinate with the campaigns at all. But you need to look at the, you know, what the other side is buying and what the weaknesses are, what the polling looks like. So let's just talk about of the incumbents right now, the ones that are Democratic incumbents, whose races are we most worried about?
I would say some of the ones you expect. I mean, I'll start by saying I never in a million years actually thought the list would be as small as it is. At the end of 2018, the beginning of 2019, I would have thought the frontline list, which is, you know, the DTRIP's official list of the most vulnerable seats in Congress, of which I think you were on, right? Mm-hmm. Is it was, you would have thought that the people who would still be vulnerable right now would be a good chunk of that list. And so many of them, it really feels like, okay, they're fine, actually.
Yeah.
But I would say New Mexico too, like that's a tough seat. It's represented by Xochitl Torres Small. You know, she's a little bit down in the polls, but I don't think I ever saw a poll in 2018 that she was up. And she,
yeah.
You know, so polls are not right. Like there's a lot to them, and I believe in them. Yeah. I'm not one of those naysayers about polls. I look at them all the time and trust a lot about them, but they're not perfect.
Right. Yeah. Like some of the polls that a lot of the polls that were outside polls of my district when I was running, had me down even to the last days. And then I ended up winning by almost 9 points. So, you know, especially if you're, if a lot of your election depends on, you know, harder to reach voters, these are ones that are maybe not English speaking or are more rural or younger or less likely to answer their phones, then you're not going to get, you're going to have a higher likelihood of not capturing your actual voters. And so if she outperforms this time, then we've got to assume that it's something like that, you know.
Oklahoma 5, Kendra Horn.
Yep. That's on our her time list too.
That's a hard seat.
Yeah, the fact that you flipped a seat in Oklahoma in the first place is definitely.
And look, she was the surprise of 18, right? There weren't people spending and investing there. I mean, some folks, obviously, but it wasn't one of those, most of the orgs across the board are there and are spending and are helping. That was the, wait, who just won?
Yeah.
In that seat?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was the DCCC. I don't think even had her on.
I don't think so. And it's not a knock, right? I mean, she ran a great race and put together an awesome campaign, but then there's always going to be one that super surprises you. But certainly she's on a vulnerable list right now, because Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I think some of the folks in California, I mean, certainly TJ Cox is facing, a challenge from Valadao, who he defeated, I think, in a race that was called 10 or 11 days after
Day. And he won by like 500 votes or something, right?
Yeah. So he's facing a tough reelect and it's a rematch. And those are, sometimes they're beneficial, sometimes they're not. Cindy Axne has one. And I think I would not put her in this like most vulnerable column anymore. And the person she defeated, David Young, is running against her. I would say you have I don't know if what you call this one. It's in New York too, right? Jeff Van Drew, who switched parties.
everyone's I don't know. He was on the most hated list for a while.
Right. It's interesting because it's a seat where it's New Jersey, right? New Jersey's going to go blue in the presidential. Joe Biden's going to win New Jersey, but Biden's only up by two in that district. Mm-hmm. So Amy Kennedy, she's running for the first time ever for anything, but she's married to Patrick Kennedy, former congressman, and obviously of the Kennedy, the official Kennedy family, official. which helps.
That helps.
but it's a tight race. Anthony Brindisi, New York 22, upstate New York. He's going to have to outperform, I think, Biden. Again, a state where it's like, yes, you're going to win the state, but not necessarily that district. So Brindisi's, facing that a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. I think the open seat in Iowa too, that Dave Lobsack left, toss up. Rita Hart, who was on the ticket in 18 for lieutenant governor, but ultimately came up short, was sitting on that seat. And the woman who's run against Lobsack several times, at least twice, is running. And they're neck and neck. So there's a smattering of seats all over the country. I think probably my favorite candidate, I don't want to say favorite because I love so many people, but Max Rose, Staten Island.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we all love Max.
I mean, you can't be doing a better job than Max is doing, but it's Staten Island. And it's a tough seat with a D behind your name.
So for anyone who's listening that's from Santa Clarita or from California 25, the Staten Island is kind of made up of similar types as our community, where it's like cops and firefighters and, you know, the hardworking folks who have turned, unfortunately, a bit towards Trump in recent years.
The most unionized district in the country.
Which is so wild that they don't understand how, you know, how much the Republicans are trying to break down unions.
It's a challenge because they've had Republican incumbents from their district who are labor friendly, right? They belong to Republican Main Street. They take solid labor votes. And so they are faced with that issue of this person. Now, this is not true for Nicole Melanakis, who is challenging Max Rose this time. So I don't want to sound like, but I'm saying in the past, they've had Republican reps who they can be like, okay, but this person is taking the votes that my union is saying, my union is positive about them, but they belong to a party that overall, with the exception of this small caucus of them, is trying to tear down the union. So that's sort of been the challenge, I think, for the voters there when they face.
And for those who are not familiar with Max Rose, he has some of the funniest campaign ads or straight to camera.
I'm not sure if he's running against Bill de Blasio or Nicole Malinowski.
I know.
Because it's funny because every one of his ads has to tell you how terrible Bill de Blasio is instead of actually attacking his opponent.
You know what? Whatever works. What about Joe Cunningham? I'm not seeing him on here. And he was one that was another total shocker for...
Total shocker. He looks good. I gotta tell you, I haven't seen...
Oh, I thought you meant how he looks, which is also good.
Also, kudos to his wife.
Yay. Yeah.
But I haven't seen a poll that even has him in the margin of error in at least a couple months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you, Joe.
I think he's going to get reelected. And look, he figured out a special sauce for South Carolina one. Good for him.
Charming, handsome man with a baby, I think is, right. You know, he and Max are both going for that.
I don't know if Max is going for charming.
Charming is definitely not the right word.
He's going for a woman in front of the grocery store when he was encouraging people to vote for him.
Oh, geez.
But then
charming is not just Staten Island. Staten Island charm.
Staten Island charming. Yes, exactly.
Okay, so those are the people who are currently running who need to be watched. What about Abby Finkenauer in Iowa?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. That district has definitely shifted, but she's doing it well, right? She's very much embracing the all politics is local mantra. Her ads and her earned media and her social are all of her in the district talking with workers, talking about how to bring the financial aid and jobs to that district that need to happen, talking about agriculture. You know, I mean, she's the daughter of a plumber who is a member of the UA, which is the plumbers union. You know, she grew up and knows what it means for a union to be how there's food on your table and how there's healthcare. And, she really does get that and has done a great job being out in the district and talking about it. But that said, I mean, Iowa one is tricky. She's got a former newscaster running against her who is certainly trying to portray that she's more moderate than she is, which is a pretty normal Republican tactic in a lot of places. But I think Abby's done a pretty good job exposing that she's a lot more right-wing than she presents. But, you know, she's a former newscaster. She's got good name ID going into the race. She's a state legislature. Like, it's a tough race. They're both young females kind of like drawing on that.
Yeah, Republicans kind of learned from 2018 that you want to run women. Like, it's going to be harder to...
And look, and I give all the credit in the world to that, to Elise Stefanik, who is a congresswoman from upstate New York. She hollered and yelled and banged her head against a wall to no end and got shut down in 2018 by her own party on that. And in 2020, they seemed to listen a little more.
Yeah.
I don't think it's at a point she loves either, but it's better.
What do you think? I know that there was a period when her opponent, Tedrick Cobb, right? When she was getting tons and tons of money because Elise went from a moderate Republican to all in on Trump. What do you think the chances are for Tedra?
I don't see that happening. It's a couple things, right? Like her momentum just really got cut off because the reason she gained that momentum to be able to have that financial advantage was around Stefanik's performance in judiciary on impeachment. Mm-hmm. And impeachment obviously just has disappeared from the vernacular in a way that none of us anticipated because of COVID. And it just gone.
It's gone, And I remember when everyone was, I mean, because this was right before the vote to officially open the impeachment inquiry was right before I left. Like it was literally the day that I left, which was Halloween. And I remember everybody just like looking at this list, people having to decide to vote for impeachment when, you know, they knew how tough that was going to be for, well, they thought they knew how tough that was going to be for their reelections. But I honestly think, has there been a single ad against Democrats about impeachment? Because it's just not a matter. It doesn't matter.
It's not a thing. But that alternatively really cut off Cobb's sort of momentum and ability to run on that and allowed Stefanik to really pivot back to that, like, I'm a moderate and I deliver for this district. You know, so.
Yeah. That's unfortunate. What about Florida? Are there any interesting ones in Florida where there could be surprises or particular concerns?
As far as incumbents go, I mean, it's certainly the Debbie Murkowski-Powell seat, although I would say I feel 800 times better about it now than I did in September. We've really seen the numbers rebound, I think, as Biden is doing better in that district. You know, it's a district that Hillary Clinton dominated in, but it's always been a toss-up on the congressional. But she's polling in a much better place now. She's got a mayor running against her. So she did have someone come in who had the ability to finance quickly and had solid name ID. And it required a lot of this money and organization that was spent down there to happen. But I do feel good about her being reelected now. And, you know, she's ending the campaign on positive ads and, you know, sending in that final nail.
I don't want you to have to name favorites, but top people who you think might win, who would be newcomers?
I think that Carolyn Bordeaux is going to win in Georgia 7.
Okay.
Just continues that Georgia suburb and just in general, the sort of suburb shift that's happening across the country. She came really close last cycle and I think she's going to pull it off this time. I think Nebraska 2 is a good one to watch. I think Kara Eastman will probably beat Don Bacon. And it'll be interesting to see if that electoral vote goes to Joe Biden. Nebraska does their electoral votes by congressional district. So you can win one. And Obama won it in 8.
Yeah.
That's worth.
Yeah.
So that might happen. I would really love to see Dan Feehan win in Minnesota 1 against freshman Hagedorn. Dan Feehan is a former teacher. He's a vet. He's just like a really nice dad. he just is. He barely lost. It was Tim Walz, who's now the governor of Minnesota's old seat. Jim Hagedorn is such a loon. he was one of those on the radio saying crazy stuff. And he doesn't even, I mean, I hate to say this because some districts care and some don't, and that's fine. But he doesn't live in the district. He lives in Minneapolis.
I can't stand when people don't live in their district.
I mean, he's got an address somewhere, but, you know, he doesn't live there. So that would be a great one to see. I think there's all the things that I know from listening to your podcast before, the Texas seats are exciting with Gina and Christina Valenzuela and Wendy Davis and Shree in 22. I mean, there's just so much Texas that would be exciting to welcome them. And, you know, it's funny. Again, we would have thought at the end of 2018, we were spending so much money and time and effort to reelect Colin Allred and Lizzie Fletcher, who
and they're safe.
Huge flips. And they're going to be fine. I mean, it required money. It's not like no money was spent, right? I mean, there was tons. They had to raise a lot. They had to do a lot of hard work to get there. It's not to, you know, take away from any of that, but we certainly would have still thought those two seats were going to be neck and neck right now.
Right.
they look good. And instead, we're concentrating on expanding a Texas map.
So I asked Dave about this and I gave my guess, but how many net seats do you think that the Democrats will gain?
Well, 12 is my favorite number, but Dave said 12. So I don't have the same number as Dave.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you gotta mix it up.
I'll go up. I'll go 14.
Okay. 14. Okay. So I'm way high for, way high. Hey, I don't know. I don't know.
18 and I thought you were high. So
wait, what?
When you were right in 18. And
that's true. I said 40. We ended up even higher.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's so many exciting people to watch, right? Like, I mean, there's random seats like Joyce Elliott in Arkansas too, which I don't think like gets into like your MSNBC. But there's interesting things happening there. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was only a decade ago that Arkansas had 3 out of 4 congressional seats, competitive governor's races, 3 out of 4 being Democrats. And now, mm-hmm. you know,
so
just got to claw back a little bit.
Yeah, totally. We can absolutely do it. Okay. So any interesting dynamics in the Senate races that, I mean, you know, everyone's talking about the Senate. So we've got kind of like that first tier where we could probably pick up in Arizona, Colorado, Maine, North Carolina. And then there's kind of the next tier, which is what? Iowa, Montana,
Georgia. I think Colorado and Arizona are sort of done.
Yeah.
And I think Alabama is too, which is a loss. So it's only a gain of 1.
Right.
I think North Carolina looks great. We haven't seen a shift in the polls since the news about Cal's texts have come out, which is what everyone was sort of racing for.
So for those who don't know, Cal Cunningham is the one who's running, the Democrat who's running for Senate in North Carolina, and he had a little bit of a scandal, but he just totally rolled with it.
That's
what it is.
The reality is Cal's a better leader for North Carolina, undoubtedly, in a million ways.
And I think when you have Trump as president, it's pretty hard to give a shit about someone's sexting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's I don't know. I thought it was bad journalism to even call it that. It's like, I want to cuddle.
It wasn't sexting. Yeah, when they called it that, it was like very, very benign.
Like if anything, I think it reinforced like he's just a nice guy.
He's a nice guy. Yeah. Didn't he say like I want to come over and play with your hair or something like that?
But that seat looks good, you know, and obviously, you know, in Maine, no one wants to count it before it's done, but Sarah Gideon's, you know, running a great race against Susan Collins. I think this is Maine's finally like, we've done this for a long time.
We've heard enough of your stupid dance.
This would be her fifth term. They're, I think, going to move on this time around. That next year, you know, Iowa's been neck and neck for a long time now. Joni Ernst has completely changed her message. It's funny when she ran. Well, everyone knows, not everyone, but lots of people know about her ad where she said, we're going to make them squeal, right?
Jesus, forgot about that.
But I think what people forget too, is she had an ad where she shot a gun at the ACA bill, right? And it was like,
that's right.
Healthcare. And now she's running ads about how she's going to protect your pre-existing conditions.
Oh God. Difference and 6 years can make.
You know, she benefited when she got elected 6 years ago from Bruce Braley, who represented the district that Abby represents now, Iowa 1, and who I think is one of the best people who ever served in Congress, from his mistakes. He made a couple of unforced errors, and Ernst pounced on him, mm-hmm. as one should. Similarly, she was in a debate and didn't know the break price of soybeans.
And that's something you got to know.
Answer all the agriculture questions, and Greenfield was answering them, and they've pounced on that. And, you know, the Ernst campaign is blaming some audio. She was calling in from D.C. because she was doing Amy Coney Barrett hearings, and, you know, but ultimately that's not getting through. But her not having the answers on this agriculture stuff, when she talks about agriculture as a key reason she needs to be reelected, especially does have the endorsement of a lot of the ag groups in Iowa because they tend to be fairly conservative, and you know, sits on the committee. It was tough. So the Greenfield campaign is pouncing on that in a way that they should, and it's a toss up.
Yeah. And,
Greenfield describes herself as a scrappy farm kid, and it's resonating.
There you go.
We'll see. And then you have Georgia, where you have two seats, which is interesting.
Yeah.
John Ossoff, who sort of became kind of politically famous in his run for Georgia 6 in a special.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, he lost, but Lucy McBath did win. Mm-hmm. So sometimes not the district.
Yep. I just have to, like, nothing against John Ossoff, because, like, I hope he becomes the next senator. But the whole losing a race and then running for the next race up is fairly, you know, a fairly male thing to do.
Yeah, that's true. But the reason he became a little bit famous for it, right, like people run in specials and lose all the time, is because he just raised, like, an insane pile of money. So you can see where they're, you know, the Democrats were like, ooh, that's an attractive candidate to run in this seat who can raise. He had a great mailing list. And look, he's neck and neck. He could win it. I would say the third party person in this race needs to get 3-4% in order for him to do that. Otherwise, it's going to go to a runoff.
Who's the third party person?
It's like some random libertarian who's pulling from Purdue. I don't remember. But you need that human to get 3-4%. Cause it pulls from Purdue.
Got it.
And if not, then it'll probably go to a runoff, and runoffs are very
different
Southern
ballgame.
Yep. Cause in the South, you got to get 50%. You don't just win. You got to get 50% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And, it'd be on January 5th, which is real unfortunate timing.
Yeah, totally.
And you have to think about the enthusiasm in Georgia and what it is. Well, completely, I think, depend on how November, December go.
Right.
And then you've got the other race, in which, you know, Reverend Warnock is running. There's another Dem, a guy with the last name of Lieberman, who's pulling some, which it would be nice if he sort of exited. And it's Kelly Loeffler's seat, and Doug Collins, who ran the impeachment hearings for Republicans, is in it. And it's hard to see where that doesn't go to a runoff. I mean, Warnock would have to gain about 8 percentage points off of what the polling shows right now. So likely that one does too. And then you've got 2 runoffs going in one state, which also complicates and is an interesting dynamic.
We can pretty much guarantee that a ton of money will be spent there.
So much money. And then there's Steve Bullock in Montana. And it's funny because Ossoff and Bullock, if you look just on paper at their head-to-head and say, where are these guys polling? They're at about the same place, numbers-wise, versus their Republican opponents, right? They're like just around 50. It's really close. But Ossoff is riding a Biden enthusiasm happening in the state of Georgia, Biden traveling to Georgia this week. Democrats really feeling like this is a time when the state can maybe flip in their favor, or they're going to get so close.
Yeah.
Bullock is at a place where he's really convincing a bunch of people who are going to vote for Donald Trump to cross on their ballot and vote for him.
Right.
So it's an interesting way, right? Because if you just look on paper, like what races are close, you can see them and be like, they're on the same level. But their challenges and what they have to do between now and election day to get there are very different.
Right. Totally. Okay. Any last things as a, I don't know, political insider that people should know about going into Tuesday?
You call me both a queen and an insider, and it makes me feel like my senior year of high school when I was Miss Lewis County and I was voted biggest gossip. Come to fruition and paid off.
I think totally.
In the way that my parents never would have expected.
I think it 100% manifests.
You know, I just think it's exciting to see the Democrats taking new places. It's exciting to see the suburbs making the shift. It's exciting to see us playing in states, having Texas and places be a toss-up. I would say don't overlook like the Alaska Senate race. It's an interesting dynamic happening up there that if it doesn't work out this time, I think it's useful to look in the future. But to remember that and that this is not just the most important election because of Trump and how terrible he is and what he's done for the country, but also because it is going into redistricting. And this is our chance to take back some of what we should have, to get some fair lines in states, to be able to govern and be a part of things the way that we should in a lot of states like Ohio and Florida and
Ohio, which is Arizona, like the worst in terms of gerrymandering.
Right. So I think that that's, you know, so important and overlooked in the conversation. And I get that because one, the presidential is always the sexiest, and because Trump is just such an abomination. But mm-hmm. I think it's also to remember that while I think there's so much energy around all these Republicans who hate Trump, right? Like Lincoln Project, different 100 people who used to work for John McCain and 100 people who used to work for George Bush. And these people are not becoming Democrats.
They're still Republicans. They just hate Trump.
I mean, just to be clear, they want to restart. So yes, yep. They want Joe Biden. They're not lying about that. Mm-hmm. Because they want to be like, okay, so that we're done. Yeah. Now let's start again. Let's become the Republican Party of our father. Let's become the John Thunes. He's a senator from South Dakota, who I use as an example. A lot of just like the classic Republican chamber,
right?
This guy, they do want to go back to that, and they do want to be in charge.
Definitely. So let's not think that they're ongoing allies.
Right. And just remember that things shift, right? Like I was chatting, you know, and looking at, I went to look at the votes before, in 1992 was the first year of the woman, right? And we've called lots of years the year of the woman now.
Right.
And watching Amy Coney Barrett get sworn in by Clarence Thomas made me go look at, I wonder who voted for Clarence Thomas and who didn't. And as I was going through it, I was like, oh my God, we had two Republican senators from the state of Oregon. We had a Democrat from Nebraska. We had a Republican from Vermont. We had a Democrat from South Carolina. Like, just to remember that, like, there are shifts, right?
Right,
like,
right.
This happens, and it's not necessarily all a game. Sometimes it's, if you're taking this, you're forgoing this. And right. We don't want to just forgo other things either.
Right.
As we're, you know, creeping into the suburbs, you don't want to be like, we don't need rural. Well,
right.
That's not the attitude or the play.
Right.
So that's sort of my ending thoughts. We're maybe a little scattered.
No, I love it. I love it. I think for me, the biggest lesson from all of this is that I think that people have been, have become so much more politically aware than they were 4 or 6 years ago. And yeah, I mean, really before Trump, this has caused a whole group of people, a whole generation of voters who are paying attention to all kinds of races that they wouldn't have otherwise. It started with 2018 in the House races. You know, it's expanded into the Senate now. And I think more and more people are even paying attention to the state legislatures. But what I think the resounding message needs to be afterwards, especially because as Democrats, we have a tendency to get real complacent. And if we don't keep that going, that focus going, then we could be in a position where we lose 900 state legislature seats across the country, or that we just take massive losses the next time that there is a, you know, once Republicans start to become palatable again, which is not necessarily that far off. It could just take a couple of years for them to, you know, figure out that Trump is so toxic and start to win people back. I mean, I can certainly tell you that my dad does not want to continue voting for Democrats, you know? I mean, he's going to until there's something better, but like there's a lot that he's, you know, not comfortable with about what Democrats are pushing for. And, you know, I think the only option for us is to keep paying attention and to keep investing in those races where it's close and to not lose sight of it. So hopefully that's what happens. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really grateful to have you here. Look forward to getting cocktails soon. And tell Simone I say hi.
I will. I'm so sad she didn't get to talk to you.
Oh, well, we'll talk to her soon. All right, cool. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Bye. That was fantastic. Thank you so much to Nicole for joining us. Remember, if you haven't, I guess already at this point, I don't know how to help you, but you can visit nakedpoliticspodcast.com and click on vote. It redirects you to vote.org, where there are great resources out there. You better have a voting plan if you haven't already voted, because now we know that the Supreme Court is doing everything that it can. The state courts are doing everything that they can in many places to make sure that ballots are not counted. The post office has said that they can't guarantee that your mail-in ballots will be received by election day at this point. And if you're in a state where they're going to throw those out, you're going to have to drop it off in person or vote in person and make sure that you do that, because I cannot think of a single thing more heartbreaking than for your vote not to count in this election. Also, be sure to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts and tell your friends about the show. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.